BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Turn Up for the Books, a podcast brought to you by BBC Arts. I'm Simon Savage.
I'm Irenison Okoje.
And I'm Dan Smith.
And over 10 episodes of this podcast, we'll be talking to a host of amazing guests about their love of reading, books and libraries.
In this episode, we'll be talking to TV and radio presenter Vic Hope about her love of books and her experience of judging the Women's Prize for Fiction earlier this year.
And I'm sure we'll be asking about her love of libraries too.
And of course, we'll be reflecting on the BBC's Novels That Shaped Our World list. These 100 books are broken down into 10 categories, and on each episode, we'll be discussing some amazing novels from the last 300 years.
Today's theme is adventure, which could and does encompass so many types of novel. Are you guys adventurous readers?
I would like to think so.
I feel like we had this question in another episode as well, and all I could think of was like contexts of reading, like hanging upside down or, I don't know, up a mountain or something. But obviously that's not
reading the way, issue bungee.
The way the question was intended. Yeah. What about you? Are you adventurous? Do you like to challenge yourself, or is it a comforting thing?
I've been thinking about this a lot recently because I really want to read Dune at the moment, and to me that seems like way out of my sort of remit for reading. So I think I would like, and also I've been in a book funk recently, and I think when you're in a book funk,
can you translate book funk for those of
us who don't know?
Yeah, sorry. I love the expression, but it's obviously not one that I know of. Tell me.
It's when you kind of can't settle on a book and you're not quite in the mood for reading. Or you can sometimes have a book, it can be started off by a book hangover where you've read something amazing. But often people will say when you're having a book funk, head to something you've already read and loved. But I've actually been thinking, maybe I just need to shift what I'm reading a little bit. Maybe that's what the issue is. So I would like to be a bit more adventurous. And Dune seems to be so outside my wheelhouse, I think it's going to be an adventure.
Yeah, that's definitely an adventurous book. So go for it. But I know what you mean about being in a funk. And it does help, actually, to step outside of your comfort zone. One of the things I used to do was go to charity shops and buy books because, you know, it's not dictated by my choice necessarily. It's just what's available. So I would always pick like a mix of books and go home and read something very different. And I mean, that kept it exciting. That kept that process of discovering books really interesting. So I think I read quite widely anyway. Like, I don't consider myself a book snob, even though I am a literary writer.
For those of you who couldn't see, which is everyone, there were air quotes there,
Yeah, definitely. But no, I like everything because it's all, you learn something from each category. So it's good to mix it up and it keeps things interesting.
I have tried some romance recently. It was quite steamy. And I found it quite...
What did you go for?
It's the Brown Sisters trilogy by, and the name is going to escape me, Talia Hibbert. And they're also very comforting in the fact that once you've read one, you know what you're going to get from the next two. Okay. But it was something different for me and it was great. But also what you said about charity shops, libraries, of course, are brilliant for that as well. Like, I have not been into a library in a while, which is very bad of me. Well, I have actually, lots for work, but not in terms of to have a good browse. I'm generally in a meeting. So I think that's probably what I need to do, is have a good browse through the shelves.
Yeah, the recommendation section. Libraries. I love it, both in library and indie bookshops where like the staff recommends their favourite books, people that work there. That's always a really nice way to discover things you might not have thought to read.
Absolutely. Right. Indie bookshops are a great tip as well, I think.
So good. Yeah.
I would agree completely. But let's take a look at the 10 books in the adventure list. They are City of Bohan by Kevin Barry.
Eye of the Needle by Ken Follett.
For Whom the Bell Tolls by Ernest Hemingway.
His Dark Materials trilogy by Philip Pullman.
Ivanhoe by Walter Scott.
Mr. Standfast by John Buchan.
The Big Sleep by Raymond Chandler.
The Hunger Games by Susan Collins.
The Jack Aubrey Novels by Patrick O'Brien.
And the Lord of the Rings trilogy by J.R.R. Tolkien.
That's a big one.
It is, and there's a lot of series here again. We've had this on a previous selection. They like a good old series. What leaps out on this list for both of you?
City of Bohan by Kevin Barry. I haven't read it, but I do like Kevin Barry's writing. I loved Beetlebone, which was sort of hilarious and freewheeling. And this premise of, I guess, warring gangs trying to take over a city in the future where there's minimal laws and minimal technological advancement, that's almost the opposite of what you'd expect for a future environment.
Yeah.
So I'm curious about his thinking in regards to that. And yeah, what that world looks like, because it sounds like it would be chaos. but also with Kevin's sort of signature humour as well. So that, yeah, that stands out to me.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much here, isn't there? There's kind of fantasy, science fiction. There's loads of world building. Obviously, Middle Earth, the Lord of the Rings trilogy by Tolkien, for those who've read them and read, you know, obviously seen the films, they are, you know, that's it's probably one of the most famous adventures you can, you know, in literary history, I guess.
Yeah, it's a giant of the genre, isn't it? I mean, its reputation precedes it in a way. I'm still intimidated to read the books because I feel like, yeah, there's such dense, rich worlds.
I feel like it's interesting. There are people for whom they were a massive part of their childhood and those who were like, nah.
I was in the nah category. But I have read the first of his Dark Materials trilogy and I really, really liked it. But then the second one, The Subtle Knife, there was something about a knife that could cut through dimensions and I was like, whoa, we've gone away. You know, I was happy with the
I thought you said you were trying to be an adventurous reader.
I'm talking about like years ago. But my gran, I remember my gran, who's sadly no longer with us, but she was a huge reader. And she went to the Philippines on holiday and the only books left in the hotel were the His Dark Materials trilogy. And it was so not her thing, but she read them because there was nothing else to read. Apparently she wept, absolutely wept at the end, and then started to try a bit of YA now and again. So there we are. That's a fact. Thanks, Philip Pullman, for that.
We also were, when we were talking about this list beforehand, kind of noticed how author-wise, male-dominated it is.
Yes.
As a category. Apart from, of course, Suzanne Collins, who wrote The Hunger Games, which, again, a kind of dystopian adventure idea. I love that she got the idea for the novels when jumping between... I just read this earlier, but it's probably written down here. Sorry, I'm being such an idiot. She was watching news on the war in Iraq and also game shows. And the combination of kind of competitivism and weird TV worlds and sort of violence of reality via the news kind of fused into that idea. It also reminds me a lot of there's a film called Battle Royale, which I don't know if any of you have seen. It's a like brilliant Japanese film.
Yeah.
About a class of kids who once every year a class of kids are taken to an island and all given a weapon and it's last man standing. And it's an absolutely bonkers but brilliant Japanese classic film, which I think the premise of this really reminded a lot of people of. But I've gone way off track.
No, I thought it's funny actually you mentioned Battle Royale. I thought of that immediately as well as soon as I saw it on the list. I expected it to be on here because it was a massive hit. The Hunger Games, also adapted into a film. But I think the twist for me is the fact that they're children.
Yes,
it's just brutal.
Yeah.
That element. Hugely successful novel, and I think, yeah, in terms of women writers, it would be great to see more names on the list because we're missing them. And we know that they are out there. So, yeah, I would like to see more of them on the list.
And, of course, Hemingway with For Whom the Bell Tolls, a classic. So, like, again, I guess we're seeing a real cross-section of kind of popular fiction and sort of more... like literary establishment.
Well, also, that's one that I wouldn't in my head have gone, oh, adventure. Do you know what I mean? I wouldn't put that in that category necessarily. But, and that's what I think is really great about all of the categories we've had, because there's been novels that we might have put in other ones, like, for example, you know, I think probably in here I would put Sherlock Holmes as adventure for me personally, or actually The Witches, which we've talked about. That's kind of an adventure in itself. So I guess it's just, it's all very much on the... judges, as Juno, who we've had on, it's kind of what their mindset of adventure was, or what was an adventure for them. And yeah, I'm trying to think of any current ones that I would love to see on that list.
I'm surprised not to see The Life of Pi by Jan Martel on the list, because that was such a massive success. You know, lovely, strange story about a young boy who survives a shipwreck, finds himself on this boat in the Pacific with a tiger, a monkey, an orangutan. And it's a bit like Battle Royale again. They sort of fight to the death,
yeah,
until he's stuck with this, left alone with this tiger. And it's it just gets stranger and stranger. It's a really, really wonderful read. So yeah, that would have been brilliant on this list, I think. But I'm really pleased also to see Raymond Chandler, The Big Sleep. I love a good noir,
yeah,
story. And again, that has, you know, it's got your jaded detective. It's pacey. The dialogue is great. And I love old dialogue-driven books because it's just got a particular rhythm to
You're
it.
You're there in the room with them.
Absolutely.
In the conversation.
And it's so atmospheric. So, yeah, it's great to see that on the list. Of course, the film is brilliant as well with Bacall and Humphrey Bogart. So, yeah, I love that this is on here.
Really, really sort of, despite the sort of quite male-leaning authors, it's quite a mixed list of worlds and contexts and settings, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. We've got a whole range here. But there are so many that I haven't read.
Yeah.
So I feel like, yeah, there's some really, really interesting recommendations here that I will be pursuing.
Yeah, the Jack Aubrey novels as well, the kind of, say, it's the swashbuckling master and commander, naval ships. That's like a whole world. Yeah, again, I've just not explored yet. But, well, you know, now that I've seen it on this list, it's I'll put it on the pile. Maybe not at the top, but it'll be on the pile.
I think June could count an adventure. Or could count as an adventure. Yes, sure. So that's going to be my future adventure read. There we go.
Now, the University of Wolverhampton has been conducting research into our Novels That Shape the World list throughout 2021, speaking to readers and getting their thoughts on the books in all the categories. Here's the head of that study, Professor Sebastian Schroes, to tell us more.
The adventure category was really the most popular category. We had the most respondents and recommendations to this category for novels that shaped our world. What's really interesting is why people responded to the idea of the adventure category. Of course, the program ran during the pandemic. We're all into lockdowns. And we saw that there was 33% more reading in general. But maybe there was something to do with being isolated, being quarantined, and we wanted to travel vicariously and have novels take us away to faraway places that we can visit. So that may be one thing why the adventure category was very popular with the audience. So escapism, maybe, and maybe thinking about how we can have excitement during a very boring period. Maybe those are two things that that can explain the popularity of the adventure category. My team looked at the data and we discovered kind of two trends. So the first one was really that people were really interested in large, expansive universes that sort of tapped into fantasy imaginary worlds. So H. Rider Haggard's Victorian Tales of Alan Quatermain was mentioned, for instance. Terry Pratchett's Discworld was very popular, and lots of series and trilogies were very important for people. So not just a slim novel, but really expansive worlds. They really wanted this kind of immersion into fantastic worlds. The Harry Potter series was extremely popular, and there's something to say about the age groups there. So you can really see that Harry Potter has really shaped a number of generations, particularly younger generations. It's a really kind of interesting kind of result there. The other kind of trend that we saw in the adventure series was that children's fiction was very popular. Novels like Peter Pan, Alice in Wonderland, The Lemony Snicket, and Artemis Fowl were really popular. So I'm not sure if this has anything to do, again, with the pandemic, but when people were thinking about adventure, they went back to their childhood. So there's something really interesting in the sense that when people think of adventure, they think of imagination and fantasy, and they go back to their childhood fiction. And what's interesting here is maybe there's an overlap between the imagination that children's fiction offers, but also with the state of mind that you have as a child. So what you can see here is that fiction and real life are always intermingling. There is no separation of our lived experience and the books that we read. They kind of merge and become part of one experience that we remember in later life.
I thought that fact about 33% of reading going up by 33%, sorry, during the pandemic was interesting. And also that's been shown in libraries where membership has gone up by, I think somebody came up with like 300%. I mean, it is huge how many people joined the libraries during the pandemic, which is phenomenal.
Yeah, amazing.
Obviously people's desire to escape and be somewhere else and live in another world, but also, like, you know, I think the pandemic has meant loads more people have engaged with their communities so much more and probably realised there was a library locally for those who haven't joined.
And libraries have been really good in terms of engaging back. So last year, I think, during the pandemic, the reach of libraries went up to 250 million, which is like
that's
social
fantastic.
Media. That's huge.
That's amazing. That's amazing. That's really great.
So it's been like a, that just interests me. One thing that did come to me, though, when we were talking about nostalgia, or when Sebastian was talking about nostalgia, was I was thinking, actually, of Jill Murphy and The Worst Witch. That's a book that I would put on this list. And actually, without those books, I wouldn't be the reader I am. And she sadly passed away very recently as we're recording this. And, those books gave me that sort of real sense of adventure, but in a very, I don't know, there's something very safe about the environment whilst you're going, and books are brilliant for that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's that thing, again, about hearkening back to childhood that really struck a chord, you know, those comfort reads that make you feel like, I don't know, there's an element of freedom in your life and in your world and what the possibilities that can come from that. And people actually taking the time during the pandemic to return to that is wonderful, I feel.
Yeah, totally. And in, I guess, in so many children's books, because they're allowed to be way more, well, not allowed to be, but they often are so much more kind of fantastical and expansive. That so lends itself to this. I think it's really interesting that Alice in Wonderland's not there. So many of the books of Roald Dahl, you know, which obviously we've touched on him a little bit, but, you know, they're all these kind of madcap adventures. I was thinking of Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy as well, as something that very much, very easily could have been here. And also, seeing as there have been a few examples of graphic novels as well, there's obviously this all of the, you know, the sort of long illustrious history of the comic book and all of these amazing graphic novels that build worlds and take readers into such, you know, vastly different places and dystopias and utopias and different versions of reality. So that, you know, there's that as well. I guess, like with everything, trying to pick 10, I mean, trying to categorize full stop is a nightmare. I imagine it must have been really tricky for those picking these. And then also, just picking 10, how do you do it? And here's the result, I guess.
Yeah, there's always going to be stuff missing from the list, depending on who picks what.
But that's what's great about a list, I think. It's the discussions that you have from it. What was missing, what you thought there might be someone you didn't like and you wouldn't say were adventurous. I mean, I don't know, it depends on what your term of adventurous, I guess. Mine's obviously about witches and brooms or going on adventures with Sherlock Holmes. But yeah,
how,
I think that's
that series, is it? How long was that series?
That series, The Worst Witch, I think there were 8 in total and she started them in the 70s and she only did them, well, she did one recently about 3 years ago.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, they've been going. And it's been interesting because I've headed back to Mildred Hubble, who's the main character, that every time a new one's come out. And it's just been they're really good for a book funk.
Talk to me about the new one, because obviously that's, if it's been around since the 70s, was it kind of updated? Was it brought into the modern world?
No, not at all.
And that's great that it wasn't. Yeah.
It's just all based around Miss Cackle's Academy for Witches, and that was it. It was just its own little world. And it was the proper, I think, witch story pre-HP.
Wow. That's controversial. I love it.
Yeah. Anyway.
There's a soundbite.
I would have also loved to see Dave Eggers' book, You Shall Know Your Velocity. It's such a funny story about these two friends who take a large sum of money to remote parts of the world and try to give it away, and the locals don't respond very well to it. But it's so big-hearted and warm. I really love that novel. So that came to mind just while we were having this conversation.
I love hearing that research, though. It's so fascinating to hear, particularly in the context of, you know, of the lockdowns and the pandemic. Because, I don't know, the album that we've just made, the band that I'm in, is all about escapism, and it's all about escape via various different means, from like technology to whatever, but like a lot of it is about escaping into other worlds via fiction and via like novels and films, and these worlds that are created by these incredible authors, all of these amazing classic books, and that have created these worlds, these science fiction versions of reality, versions of the future, you know, that comment on the now and on the past, but like, you know, how key it's been in the pandemic to escape and to be somewhere else and to step inside somebody else's mind and their head and their world and go somewhere that's miles away from your reality. It's been vital, and like in our work has been a really key kind of inspiring thing to hold on to.
No, no, totally.
That's
totally
brilliant. It sounds like portals within portals, exactly, which I love. That's really cool. Time now to welcome our special guest for this episode. As well as being a children's author, TV presenter and former Strictly star, she is also currently the co-host of Radio 1's Drive Time show with Jordan North.
Alongside her media and writing work, she's also a human rights activist and campaigner. We're of course talking about Vic Hope. Hello Vic, and welcome to Turn Up for the Books. How are you?
Oh, hello. Yeah, I'm really good, thank you. How are you?
Good.
Yeah, good. Thanks. So nice to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, any opportunity to chat about books is fine by me. Best
this
conversation.
Is what
that's
we
brilliant.
Like.
Yeah. Love that.
We could be hours.
Yeah. How long have you got?
No, it just makes you feel good, doesn't it? I was thinking this the other day. We've been inside for a long time, we've been in our four walls, but the opportunity to just escape to other worlds is, it's a real honor, it's really special, and I feel very lucky to have it. I feel like it's the best thing that we have.
Yeah, everyone who's come on the show has been has sort of, you know, said the same sentiment. It's just this amazing way, particularly over the last couple of years, to escape, to embody someone else, to kind of find out about the world and to travel and to, yeah, like you said, it's just the perfect escapist tool, isn't it?
Yeah, someone said the other day that through reading we gain empathy because we walk a day in someone else's shoes. We look at things through their perspective, and it's so important. And that's what makes us kind. That's what makes us smart. That's what makes us love one another, is by having empathy. And yeah, we get that through novels. We get that through novels more than we get that through any other media, more than film or TV, because we truly understand all the different facets of what makes us think and feel.
Absolutely. And obviously it's clear that you're a really great big book lover, which is wonderful. But I wondered if you could talk a little bit about your first experience of a book that really had an impact on you and opened you up to the world, and also your first experience of being in a library and what that was like, because for me it was just absolutely magical, and I would say it changed my life. So I'm just curious as how it was for you.
You know what? So Christine, who used to pick us up from school when my mum couldn't because she was working, Christine used to take us. There was two places she'd take us. She'd take us to the library, or she'd take us to the airport, to Newcastle Airport, where we'd just watch the planes coming in. We didn't go anywhere. they had this like roof bit that we could stand on and watch the plane. So we'd do that. And then we'd go to the library as well. And that was probably my first experience of a library, in Gosforth in Newcastle, me and Louis, one of my little brothers. So I must have been about 4 or 5 and he will have been in a buggy, so like 1 or 2. And yeah, we'd go, and I can still remember the smell of the books. Like, it's like quite a visceral sensory experience. I couldn't tell you which books I was reading at that age, but I could tell you how it smelt. There was kind of like I remember it smelt a little bit like rocket. You know, the leaf. They smell like a little bit like rocket mixed with sort of like a sweet mustiness. I remember the pages used to be quite yellow. They were obviously very old books, children's books. And yeah, I remember thumbing through them and just being really excited for those visits, for those trips to the library to be experiencing and to be introduced to lots of different worlds. I guess in a similar way to when we went to the airport and watched the planes go and wondering where they were going to other worlds as well. There was a transportation that I guess was similar for both of those trips out. But the first book that really changed me was probably Noughts and Crosses by Mallory Blackman, which was the first time that I'd ever seen an interracial relationship that wasn't my mum and dad. I grew up in 90s Newcastle, and we were the only kids in our school who were of mixed heritage. Actually, there was no black kids either, but I remember being less confused about my mum's family, who are from Nigeria, because I was like, I feel like I've seen that before. I feel like I get it, but I hadn't seen anyone who was a mix of two. And I don't know. When you don't see yourself, you don't fully understand your place in the world. You don't really know where you belong. And when you're a kid, all you want is to fit in, isn't it? And this was the first time I read a book, and there was this relationship between the Noughts and the Crosses, Seffi and Callum, black and white. And it I think it helped me to understand that maybe I wasn't alone. Also, it helped me understand what my parents would have gone through in the 70s and 80s, being an interracial couple in the northeast of England, which was not easy. I understood their struggles and I understood their sacrifice and I understood their love. And I guess I found solace on the pages of Noughts and Crosses. I felt a little bit less alone, a little bit more validated, a little more confident. I think, you know, you can't be what you can't see. And when kids see themselves represented in books, on the TV, they gain a confidence that they can be anything. And yeah, I think it made me a bit more sure of my place in the world, a bit more sure of wanting to fight for justice, for equality, seeing that the world wasn't a just or equal place. It also made me want to write. It made me think, you know what? Like, we've all got stories to tell. This is like my mum and dad's stories. Maybe I could write a story one day. So yeah, it gave me a lot, that book.
That's amazing. And you talk about seeing yourself reflected. This is something we have discussed over and over again on the podcast. It's so important because, like you said, it makes you feel seen and validated. And also you can fully step into who you are, you know, when you see yourself on the page, like when you absorb those stories. So it's an amazing thing.
How old were you when you read Noughts and Crosses?
Oh, young, pretty young. I think, I reckon around 7 or 8. Could I have been? Or could I have not been? Because it's 20 years old now. I must have been 10. It must have been brand new. I must have been 10. It is 20 years old now, isn't it? Because I interviewed Mallory Blackman the other day. And honestly, the most nervous I've ever been for any interview of my life, because I cared so much. And I felt like I was meeting a proper rock star, proper legend. And she was just everything. She was wearing a t-shirt because it was Endgame, which is the final book in the series, even though she said it's been ending like a million times over the last 20 years, and she just keeps it started as a trilogy and she just kept adding books to it. She was wearing a t-shirt that had like the names of all of the characters on it, and I don't know, she just loved those characters so much. And I feel like they have given so many kids and adults now who were, you know, 10 years old when they read it, just like I was maybe, a whole new perspective on the world. And I think she's so impactful, and I just think it's the most special piece of literature.
That must have been amazing
adults.
And mildly terrifying to meet her.
But
when someone that you admire that much lives up to your expectations, it's like really incredible.
Yeah, and she gave a lot of herself as well. I think that I'd always assumed that there was a lot of her own experience in that novel, but I hadn't realised to just what extent that was the case. And that was interesting. Like, I think that's probably always the case, but the way that she spoke about it, so like, I don't know, it was so relatable. I heard so much of my mum's story in there as well, and yeah, it felt really felt like something I will never forget.
Oh, that's really amazing. I'm so glad you had that experience. Sorry to slightly clunkily move things back to a kind of library direction, having just heard you talk so amazingly about your relationship with that book. But like, growing up and I guess in your kind of adult life and teenage life, did you have any sort of like particularly memorable or funny experiences with libraries? Because we're sort of looking at things through the lens of that, and you know, and the kind of profound and daily experiences that people have with them growing up, and yeah, the effect they had on their lives.
Yeah, I mean, I've spent a lot of time since those early days in Gosforth Library in Newcastle in fairly frightening libraries. So I went to uni in Cambridge, and whoa. I went to Emmanuel College and studied languages, but I really focused a lot on literature, so I was in the library a lot. And our college library, I've slept in there, I've showered in there. They had showers. I mean, it says a lot about the establishment, doesn't it? They had showers in there. They knew we were staying. The university library, though, the UL, that was something else. Like, that is one of the only places in the UK that has a copy of every book ever published in the UK and around the world. Like, it was the most intimidating place. It looked like a prison. And I'm not going to lie, it felt like a prison a lot of the time as well, because we were under a lot of pressure. But I spent day in, day out in that library.
Would you think the longest stint you ever did at the uni?
Oh, well, see, I broke my leg in my final year at uni playing football. And so I was on crutches. So I didn't even do the whole, like, let's leave for half an hour and have a little walk, because I could barely walk. I was in crutches and in a cast. So I just stayed. So I think longest stint, we weren't allowed to stay there overnight. That had to close. I think it was pretty late, though. It was like midnight. Mm-hmm. I reckon I've done a good 12-hour stint in there. I remember writing my dissertations in final year and just getting lost. The place, like finding the book that you're looking for was in itself a mission. I would reward myself for that, for just finding it. Because it was this
job
massive
done. Day's work.
Maze. Tick that off my list. I'm literally on your to-do list. Find novel. Because I was doing a lot of... I was doing a lot of Francophone Caribbean literature and also like Latin American literature. A lot of those books couldn't leave the library. So I had to basically copy out huge passages, pages and pages of novels because I couldn't take the books out. I spent a lot of time in there. I mean, we had a lot of fun in there. I remember my friends would always like, if they knew any of us were doing a stint in the Emmanuel College Library, which was open 24/7, you know, they'd bring some beers, which we'd like, obviously not drink near the books, not allowed. No one hears us. And they'd bring snacks and food. And, you know, we'd sort of agree if we were in a bit of a, we'd have these sort of like breakout rooms. We'd agree when we'd all take our breaks so that we could put some music on. And I remember once there was we had a mild earthquake in Cambridge. And I'll never forget because it was late at night. And you knew who had been in the library late at night because they felt the earthquake because it was at like 1 a.m. And anyone talking about the earthquake the next day, you were like... You did a shift, didn't you?
Wow.
I'm going to detour slightly from libraries, although I have mentioned on this podcast that my mum took me to uni with her when she was 18 and I was 3. What I haven't said is that the uni was Newcastle, and she used to take me... We used to live in Gosforth, and she used to take me to the airport some weekends as well. That's so spooky.
No. I'm going to mention this. Did you go and watch the planes at the roof?
Yeah, because like as a single mum at like 18, it was like a free day out. It was amazing. Yeah. So that's what you used to go and do. So sorry, I just had to mention that.
No, but... I'm so excited to hear that other people did that. I actually didn't know. I assumed that other people who were there were actually going on holiday, but we literally would go every week. We never went anywhere. We just watched the planes and we like waved to them.
Yeah, that was exactly the same. Although I think I was about a decade before, so let's move swiftly on. But the other thing that bringing up my mum is that me and my mum read the Women's Prize long list together every year. It's kind of become this routine thing we do. And obviously you were a judge alongside Nesrine Malik, Sarah Jane, me, and two of my mates, Bernardine Evaristo and Elizabeth Day.
Legends.
How was that experience for you? Because it must have been incredible, but also slightly daunting when all those books start arriving.
Yeah, when they arrive in a huge box, you've realised what you've let yourself in for. But, oh my God, I didn't expect it to affect me the way that it did. I think, you know, we all get into our reading habits and we have certain novels or certain genres that we will gravitate towards, and that's fine because we have very little spare time in our busy daily lives. So why would you read something that's not your favorite type of book? Because we only read so much. But being the word forced is not the right word, but being encouraged to read outside of your comfort zone was so liberating and so mind expanding. I love thrillers now. I'm so into them. And if a book wasn't fulfilling the criteria fairly early on, when it came to excellence, accessibility, originality, then, you know, maybe you wouldn't finish it. And I think we were allowed to say that. But I think overall, we each got an initial allocation of about 50 to 60 books. And then we read the whole long list, obviously, and then the short list, rereading a lot of those books. We read about 70 books over about, what was it? Was it 5 months or was it 3 months? It was a very short period of time anyway, but it was a full lockdown and it couldn't have been, the lockdown wasn't great. It was not easy. It was very, very difficult for so many people for so many reasons. But if there's one positive I will take from all of this, it's how the stars aligned with that. Just spent all my time alone in my house reading, and there was
managed to do it.
If you're going to do it, yeah.
Yeah, and I imagine that your experience at Cambridge must have sort of set you up a little bit for having to be able to just ingest all these stories and all this material.
You're right, you know, I hadn't really thought of it like that, because I always think that having gone to uni and having had that sort of pressure, and there was a lot of pressure at Cambridge, I fell out of love with reading for quite a long time. And couldn't make myself love it again because I just had these sort of feelings of the sheer volume of stuff that we had to get through, for reasons that weren't always passion and love of literature. But yeah, you're right. But I think I got to a place in recent years where I learned to relax into reading again, learned to read things that made me happy, learned to read things that transported me, that gave me the escapism that I feel like I needed. But I only allowed myself to do them in downtime. So on holiday, or if I had a bit of time off at the weekend, I put an hour aside and be like, this is my reading time. I can enjoy it. Whereas doing it for the Women's Prize for Fiction, it had to become that sort of Cambridge mentality of every spare second in between work, in between anything that you're doing, you've got to get through these pages. And I did start reading very, very fast. But that's not to say I wasn't enjoying it. I loved it. I loved, as I said before, I loved being utterly transported to all of these worlds when I couldn't even leave my four walls. And I guess, yeah, my eyes were open to the scope of human experience. There were so many shoes that I could step into, so many characters who felt so many things, some that I had felt, some that I haven't, some that I will. And it just, yeah, it made me feel like a more whole person at a time when sometimes we were feeling a bit lacking. It was an amazing thing. And then you mentioned, obviously, Bernardine and Elizabeth Day and all these amazing women, to be able to then discuss them and hear their viewpoints. So we had this spreadsheet, and it was the highlight of my day every single evening, getting home from work, be able to look in the spreadsheet, because everyone was updating it in real time. And we all had our columns and we all had the books, and people would write what they thought of them. And what an insight into the way that different people think and feel if you see how a book has affected them and you see it as it happens, because sometimes those comments would change. You'd look back the next day and you're like, oh, Bernardine, you've changed how you feel about it. Because sometimes you need to let it sit with you. And it was because we hadn't really met each other we'd met each other once for a meeting, but we hadn't spent that much time together because the world locked down. So we were getting to know each other through our reviews of books as they were happening. And I was so nervous at the beginning because I thought I was the stupidest of the lot. And I was like, oh, maybe I'm not reading these things in the way that I should be. Maybe I don't get it. Maybe I haven't experienced enough of the world. But it was almost quite validating to see that we all feel different things, and that's okay. And in some ways, once you get through to the shortlist stage, there is no winner, because everyone has a favourite for a reason that we can't necessarily relate to. We have all experienced the world in different ways. And I always say a good book is a book that changes the way you look at the world, but also changes the way you look at yourself. We've all had different lives. So, yeah, just seeing how these books had affected these women, who I have so much respect for, was absolutely mind-blowing, and I love it.
It's amazing to hear you talk about it in such detail. It obviously really was a really exciting experience, but that shortlist is absolutely incredible. How the One-Armed Sister sweeps her house, really, I was devastated reading that book. That book stayed with me for about 2 months after I read it. I mean, it's just heartbreaking, exploration of domestic violence. But fantastic to see Piranesi win an experimental boundary pushing book, and of course the author battled through illness for a long time to write that book. So I mean, it's so exciting, and like you said, such an expansive list. I wonder though if it ever got quite heated, because you're all big personalities on that panel, so I'm just curious as to whether it did get quite heated when you were passionate about whatever book you want to fight for, and that possibly didn't make the shortlist. How did that feel? Because it's an interesting experience judging, isn't it?
In short, the answer is yes. It got really heated. No, but the thing is, getting to the long list was not too hard. I feel like when you're taking, it was 144 books down to 16, there were some easy no's, there were some sad, we called them sad no's, no's that we knew in our heart of hearts, even though we'd loved it, it wasn't quite enough. Because there's 16 and there's 5 of us, we each could have at least 3 that we were like, well, this is mine. So no one was really losing anything. But then taking that long list down to a short list of 6, that's where it got heated, and then choosing winner. Yeah, of course it did. As I said, we all had different reasons for being quite deeply in love with these novels, with these works of literature. And at this point, they are all excellent. They are all original. They are all accessible. And by accessible, we don't just mean anyone can read them. We also mean that they will stand the test of time. We want pieces of work that will be canonical as we move forward. And you know, there's books on that list that I think will be studied. I hope will be studied. I don't know if I can set out. Am I allowed to say? Because then it's not showing favoritism, isn't it? But for me, Britt Bennett's The Vanishing Half, like, changed the way I looked at myself, changed the way I looked at the world that I live in. And I think its exploration of race is one that is so multifaceted that it's necessary for kids to understand, because I think we can often look at race through quite a monolithic lens, and this expanded that. I would love that to expand the world for lots of children. So I would love that to be studied in school. But Piranesi, oh my God, who'd have thought? So I don't know if you guys have read it. I'm assuming you have, but like, for the first 50 pages, I was like, literally saying out loud, this is not for me.
When I was reading it, I was like, what's this avenue where the seagull's doing whatever it's doing? Come on, guys.
Why is this albatross always being talked about? For about 50 pages, I was audibly saying, no, not for me. And then, bam, I was in. And once I was in, I was so utterly transported, I couldn't put it down. And I think of all the books, it was the one I'd most push into other people's hands, because I'd be like, you have to try this. Like, almost like it's a food that you need to taste. You have to try it. And I can promise you, you're going to, for 50 pages, be like, I don't think so. But that's the whole point of the prize. It's to make people read something that maybe they wouldn't read. It's to uplift the voices of women. And if that voice wasn't already here, let's push it there, because that's helpful for all women. That's helpful for all women's literature. That's helpful for little girls who might be looking, thinking, maybe I want to write a novel. Well, you can. Look, you can write anything you want. You can write any story you want. And that is so, so exciting. I remember growing up, I would literally go to Waterstones and look at the table that had the Women's Prize for Fiction shortlisted or longlisted authors on, and that would be my reading list. I'd take a list of what those authors' names were, what those titles were, and that was my list for the year. So to be a part of picking that, that's a huge honour and a huge privilege, and I really hope we did it just, but I think we did. I just think that, I think of the long list more than the short list. I think that long list just was, as you said, so expansive. It had so much on there, such a rich place to mine. And I think there was something for everyone.
Incredible.
It was a cracking shortlist. It's one of the best shortlists, I think, in a while.
So in each episode of this series, we're looking at categories from the BBC's novels that shaped our word list. Today we're exploring adventure. So I wondered if there were books on that list that leapt out at you.
I think the Philip Pullman, because it takes me back to being at school, the whole trilogy. So there was The Subtle Knife, The Northern Lights, and The Amber Spyglass. I just remember reading them at school, and they were that kind of novel that you would race to get to the end of, and then you'd feel really annoyed because you're at the end and it's over and you don't have it anymore. And that was a feeling that as a child I just loved so much. And I really hope that, I think kids still feel that way. I feel like I've got three brothers, and I feel like every single one of them has been through that phase where they couldn't put books down, and especially adventure novels, especially like young adult adventure books. I think they deserve that escapism. They deserve that feverishness that you get when you can't put a book down. That's why I write like children's books. I really hope that kids can be transported to those worlds. And you know, they've had a tough time. They've been isolated. They should not be isolated, kids. So hopefully they've been able to connect and communicate and feel and live through novels that they can't put down, that they're so excited to race to the end of, and then get annoyed when they get to the end of because it's over.
There's nothing better than sort of occupying the world of a book for a while and loving it so much. You don't want it to end, but you're like racing to get there because you're loving it so much. But you're like, I don't want to leave this world. I want to occupy it forever.
I don't want to leave this world. That's it.
We found with this list of books, it's kind of, it's been really interesting seeing what was chosen and what made the list and the sort of different categories that were decided upon. But one thing that we've already found is because obviously it's so subjective, there's so much within each category that you think belongs in a different category or you feel like is missing. Was there anything from this list of adventure, because it's obviously such a huge and potentially expansive category, was there anything that you felt from your reading or your life that you loved that you thought was missing?
I feel like everything's an adventure though, isn't it? Like, we're all on an adventure through life. So any book, whether it's a Zadie Smith that's essentially quite anthropological, or whether it's like a Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, which is philosophy without philosophizing, I think that they're all adventures through life and through ourselves and through our minds. I did notice that Ernest Hemingway was on the list, and it was For Whom the Bell Tolls. I would put The Old Man and the Sea on there, because I just think it is, that's an adventure. I got really obsessed with Ernest Hemingway during my time in both Argentina and Cuba. Don't you sound like a walking cliche, but I went out, I went traveling around Cuba, and I went to live in Argentina, and I was writing out there. I was working as a journalist, and I remember while I was there reading Ernest Hemingway, reading The Old Man and the Sea, and feeling really transported. But I think for all that there is so much movement, and it's so visceral, and it's so rooted in the world and the elements, it also shows the sort of universality of experience. And I think that was quite eye-opening for me. I just think, obviously, the way he writes and the way he wrote was so understanding. He could delve into any mind, and the tumultuousness of that mind is an adventure. So I feel like that book really is a tumultuous mind and a tumultuous adventure. And it's an adventure book.
No, I think one thing that Irenison asked us earlier was if we were adventurous readers, and would you say that you're an adventurous reader?
I wasn't, because I would only read on holiday, like beyond uni, where I read very widely but very very pointedly for like a reason, I guess. I pretty much always, and this probably extends right back to being a child, my mum always put into my hands books about equality, justice, race. I think, you know, it was part of my education, so she wanted me to look at the world and to question everything, and she put books into my hands that would encourage that. And I think I've then gone through life and done the same. The majority of the books that I read, I mean, I mentioned Zadie Smith and Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie there, like books about being a young black woman have proliferated my reading list, my bookshelves, because everyone wants to relate. And I, as we said at the beginning, when I see myself on the page, I feel validated. And that's gone right through my life into adulthood. And I still feel that way. So I've always had a certain, I'm not saying it's a certain type of book, because they all tell very different stories, but you know, there's a theme. But yeah, since doing the Women's Prize for Fiction, I've started to read so much more widely and been, I guess, more adventurous in my approach to picking up books in Waterstones now. So yeah, and I'm glad for that, because it's brought me a lot of joy.
Before we let you go, Vic, I have one last question. You talk quite poignantly about your mother sharing books with you about, you know, blackness and visibility and being seen. And I love that, you know, mothers and daughters sharing literature. So I was curious if you could just expand a little bit about how your love of books has informed your activism, because I think that there's a really interesting connection. So I'd love to hear a bit more about that.
Yeah, I think, so when I was growing up, I remember my mum giving me books by Toni Morrison and Maya Angelou. But probably most notably, I remember, I think I was about 9 years old, and Mum gave me Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird, which at some point we all read. I think it was, you know, it was on the syllabus. It was like GCSE syllabus anyway. But I was quite a lot younger than the point at which I was studying it. And I read it at age 9, probably didn't understand a lot of it. Probably there was a lot of it that just went over my head, but it was my mum's copy from when she had studied it for her O-levels, and it had all of her markings in pencil, like in the margins. And so I remember reading it alongside my mum's notation, alongside my mum's, I guess, the things that she, that stood out for her. And I just remember being like triggered. I remember being at the age of 9, just so acutely aware that the world was not a fair place, that it was not an equal place, that justice wasn't necessarily always served. I think when you were young, you have this really quite clear moral compass, you know, like that's right, that's wrong. And you don't really get it when things don't fit with that. And it was just like, oh, well, that's not right. And I remember thinking, well, we should try and do something about this if we can. If there's a 9-year-old, like, you're like, what can I do? And it wasn't until I was 16, when we were then reading the book again for GCSE, that we, also in RS for GCSE, we were learning about prisoners of conscience and freedom fighters, and about how people around the world were being imprisoned, persecuted and even killed for either peacefully protesting or for just what they believe in, whether they stood up for it or not, just believing in it. And I remember being so, like, I remember having that feeling and that, like, I've been triggered. This doesn't make any sense. And I remember asking my RS teacher, Dr. Carson, at the time, I was like, is there anything we can do? And she introduced me to Amnesty International, and she was like, we can write letters. I mean, it's not a lot, but we can write letters. We can write letters to governments around the world, putting pressure on them and publicising human rights abuses. When there's publicity, sometimes they have to change their ways. You can also write letters of solidarity and support to people who are imprisoned for what they believe in. And something we started doing one lunchtime every week at school, we'd get a classroom and we'd write, and we became like a bigger and bigger group doing this. Then at uni, we'd start to like do it in me and a couple of my friends would like give we'd have our open up our bedrooms once a week and again do this thing. And because I was doing languages, there's more and more of us who spoke all different languages. A lot of the letters we were writing were to South America, and we all spoke Spanish, and you know, I had a few friends who spoke Arabic. So it all started to, I don't know, we just gained a bit of momentum, and it became a thing that I did. And since then I've worked so much with Amnesty and become an ambassador. But I think I can really pinpoint it all starting when I read To Kill a Mockingbird. And it was because it was my mum who gave it to me specifically, because she'd always brought us up very acutely aware of the fact that we're not all born as lucky as one another. We're not all born equal. And she, you know, she told us stories of growing up during the Biafran War. She told us stories about running away from air raids and from bombs and from housing soldiers, and stories about starving, stories about being fed by the British Red Cross. I'll be honest, I feel like because she was a child when she was growing up, she had gaps in her memory that she didn't fully understand the socio-political landscape that all of this was happening. But she knew what the human experience of it was. So I knew how hard it was for her. And I knew that that wasn't fair. Of course she was going to come to this country. Like, of course she was. If you could be safer, why wouldn't you? And so that was something that I just always understood. And it was almost like the inequality and the injustice and the unfairness of people being born in different skin in different countries, seeing that through my mum, then seeing it in this book, it sort of, they galvanised each other. And you sort of know, don't you? Well, that's what I want to fight for. That's what I want to do.
That's fascinating. It's so wonderful to hear you speak about this. It's been a pleasure to have you on. I think we could talk to you for hours and hours. But thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I've absolutely loved it. I've really, really enjoyed it. So thank you so much for having me.
And that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening. Be sure to check out BBC Sounds for our other episodes, which include guest appearances from musician turned vicar Reverend Richard Coles, screenwriter Jed Mercurio, author and actor Juno Dawson, and singer, model and DJ Skin.
And remember, the full list of the novels that shaped our world is available to view online. Just visit bbc.co.uk/arts.
Thanks so much for listening, and until next time, bye for now.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.